Side 2. Sphere by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 49. Norman envied his easy enthusiasm. He felt cramped and a little nervous. Above him, the pilot clanged the heavy hatch shut and dropped down to take the controls. Everybody okay? They nodded. Sorry about the view, the pilot said, glancing over his shoulders. You gentlemen are mostly going to be seeing my hindquarters. Let's get started. Mozart okay? He pressed the tape deck and smiled. We've got 13 minutes descent to the bottom. Music makes it a little easier. If you don't like Mozart, we can offer you something else. Mozart's fine, Norman said.
Mozart's wonderful, Ted said. Sublime.
Very good, gentlemen.
The submarine hissed. There was squawking on the radio. The pilot spoke softly into a headset. A scuba diver appeared at the porthole, waved. The pilot waved back. There was a sloshing sound, then a deep rumble, and they started down.
As you see, the whole sled goes under, the pilot explained. The sub's not stable on the surface, so we sled her up and down. We'll leave the sled at about 100 feet or so. Through the porthole, they saw the diver standing on the deck, the water now waist-deep. Then the water covered the porthole. Bubbles came out of the diver's scuba. We're under, the pilot said. He adjusted valves above his head, and they heard the hiss of air, startlingly loud, more gurgling. The light in the submarine from the porthole was a beautiful blue.
Lovely, Ted said.
We'll leave the sled now, the pilot said. Motors rumbled, and the sub moved forward, the diver slipping off to one side. Now there was nothing to be seen through the porthole but undifferentiated blue water. The pilot said something on the radio and turned up the Mozart.
Just sit back, gentlemen, he said. Descending 80 feet a minute.
Norman felt the rumble of the electric motors, but there was no real sense of motion. All that happened was that it got darker and darker.
You know, Ted said, we're really quite lucky about this site. Most parts of the Pacific are so deep we'd never be able to visit it in person.
He explained that the vast Pacific Ocean, which amounted to half the total surface area of the Earth, had an average depth of 2 miles. There are only a few places where it is less. One is the relatively small rectangle bounded by Samoa, New Zealand, Australia, and New Guinea, which is actually a great undersea plain, like the plains of the American West, except it's at an average depth of 2,000 feet. That's what we are doing now, descending to that plain.
Ted spoke rapidly. Was he nervous?
Norman couldn't tell. He was feeling his own heart pound. Now it was quite dark outside. The instruments glowed green. The pilot flicked on red interior lights. Their descent continued. 400 feet. The submarine lurched, then eased forward.
This is the river.
What river? Norman said.
Sir, we are in a current of different salinity and temperature. It behaves like a river inside the ocean. We traditionally stop about here, sir. The sub sticks in the river, takes us for a little ride.
Oh, yes, Ted said, reaching into his pocket. Ted handed the pilot a $10 bill. Norman glanced questioningly at Ted. Didn't they mention that to you? Old tradition. You always pay the pilot on your way down for good luck. I can use some luck, Norman said. He fumbled in his pocket. Found a $5 bill, thought better of it, took out a 20 instead.
Thank you, gentlemen, and have a good bottom stay, both of you, the pilot said.
The electric motors cut back in. The descent continued. The water was dark.
500 feet, he said. Halfway there.
The submarine creaked loudly, then made several explosive pops. Norman was startled.
That's normal pressure adjustment, the pilot said. No problem.
Uh-huh. Norman said. He wiped sweat on his shirt sleeve. It seemed that the interior of the submarine was now much smaller, the walls closer to his face.
Actually, Ted said, if I remember, this particular region of the Pacific is called the Lao Basin, isn't that right?
That's right, sir, the Lao Basin. It's a plateau between two undersea ridges, the South Fiji or Lao Ridge to the west and the Tonga Ridge to the east.
That's correct, Dr. Fielding.
Norman glanced at the instruments. They were covered with moisture. The pilot had to rub the dials with a cloth to read them. Was the sub leaking? No, he thought, just condensation. The interior of the submarine was growing colder. Take it easy, he told himself. 800 feet, the pilot said. It was now completely black outside.
This is very exciting, Ted said. Have you ever done anything like this before, Norman?
No, Norman said.
Me neither, Ted said. What a thrill.
Norman wished he would shut up.
You know, Ted said, when we open this alien craft up and make our first contact with another form of life, it's going to be a great moment in the history of our species on Earth. I've been wondering about what we should say.
Say?
You know, what words? At the threshold, with the cameras rolling.
Will there be cameras?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be all sorts of documentation. It's only proper, considering.
So we need something to say, a memorable phrase.
I was thinking of, this is a momentous moment in human history.
Momentous moment? Norman said, frowning.
You're right, Ted said. Awkward, I agree. Maybe a turning point in human history?
Norman shook his head.
How about a crossroads in the evolution of the human species?
Can evolution have a crossroads?
I don't see why not, Ted said.
Well, a crossroads is a crossing of roads. Is evolution a road?
I thought it wasn't. I thought evolution was undirected. You're being too literal, Ted said. Reading the bottom, the pilot said. 900 feet.
He slowed the descent. They heard the intermittent ping of sonar.
Ted said, a new threshold in the evolution of the human species?
Sure.
Think it will be?
Will be what?
A new threshold?
Why not?
Ted said.
What if we open it up and it's just a lot of rusted junk inside and nothing valuable or enlightening at all?
Good point, Ted said.
950 feet. Exterior lights are on, the pilot said.
Through the porthole they saw white flecks. The pilot explained this was suspended matter in the water.
Visual contact. I have bottom.
Oh, let's see, Ted said.
The pilot obligingly shifted to one side, and they looked. Norman saw a flat, dead, dull brown plain, stretching away to the limit of the lights, blackness beyond.
Not much to look at right here, I'm afraid, the pilot said.
Surprisingly dreary, Ted said, without a trace of disappointment.
I would have expected more life. Well, it's pretty cold. Water temperature is 36 degrees Fahrenheit.
Almost freezing, Ted said.
Yes, sir. Let's see if we can find your new home.
The motors rumbled. Muddy sediment churned up in front of the porthole. The sub turned, moved across the bottom. For several minutes, they saw only the brown landscape. Then, lights.
There we are.
A vast underwater array of lights, arranged in a rectangular pattern.
That's the grid, the pilot said.
The submarine planed up and glided smoothly over the illuminated grid, which extended into the distance for half a mile. Through the porthole, they saw divers standing on the bottom, working within the grid structure. The divers waved to the passing sub. The pilot honked a toy horn.
They can hear that? Oh, sure, water's a great conductor.
My God, Ted said. Directly ahead, the giant titanium fin rose sharply above the ocean floor. Norman was completely unprepared for its dimension. As the submarine moved to port, the fin blocked their entire field of view for nearly a minute. The metal was dull gray and, except for small white speckles of marine growth, entirely unmarked.
There isn't any corrosion, Ted said.
No, sir, the pilot said. Everybody's mentioned that. They think it's because it's a metal-plastic alloy, but I don't think anybody is quite sure.
The fin slipped away to the stern. The submarine again turned. Directly ahead, more lights, arranged in vertical rows. Norman saw a single cylinder of yellow-painted steel and bright portholes. Next to it was a low metal dome.
That's DH-7, the diver's habitat, to port, the pilot said. It's pretty utilitarian. You guys are in DH-8, which is much nicer, believe me.
He turned starboard, and after a momentary blackness, they saw another set of lights. Coming closer, Norman counted 5 different cylinders.
some vertical, some horizontal, interconnected in a complex way.
There you are, DH-8, your home away from home,
the pilot said. Give me a minute to dock. Metal clanged against metal. There was a sharp jolt, and then the motors cut off. Silence. Hissing air. The pilot scrambled to open the hatch, and surprisingly cold air washed down on them.
Airlock's open, gentlemen,
he said, stepping aside. Norman looked up through the lock. He saw banks of red lights above. He climbed up through the submarine and into a round steel cylinder approximately 8 feet in diameter. On all sides there were handholds, a narrow metal bench, the glowing heat lamps overhead, though they didn't seem to do much good. Ted climbed up and sat on the bench opposite him. They were so close their knees touched. Below their feet, the pilot closed the hatch. They watched the wheel spin. They heard a clank as the submarine disengaged, then the whirr of motors as it moved away. Then, nothing.
What happens now? Norman said.
They pressurize us, Ted said. Switch us over to exotic gas atmosphere. We can't breathe air down here.
Why not? Norman said.
Now that he was down here, staring at the cold steel walls of the cylinder, he wished he had stayed awake for the briefing.
Because, Ted said, the atmosphere of the Earth is deadly. You don't realize it, but oxygen is a corrosive gas. It's in the same chemical family as chlorine and fluorine, and hydrofluoric acid is the most corrosive acid known. The same quality of oxygen that makes a half-eaten apple turn brown or makes iron rust is incredibly destructive to the human body if exposed to too much of it. Oxygen under pressure is toxic, with a vengeance. So we cut down the amount of oxygen you breathe. You breathe 21% oxygen at the surface. Down here you breathe 2% oxygen, but you won't notice any difference. A voice over a loudspeaker said, "We're starting to pressurize you now."
"Who's that?" Norman said.
"Barnes," the voice said, but it didn't sound like Barnes. It sounded gritty and artificial.
"It must be the talker," Ted said, and then laughed. His voice was noticeably higher pitched.
"It's the helium, Norman. They're pressurizing us with helium."
"You sound like Donald Duck," Norman said, and he laughed too. His own voice sounded squeaky, like a cartoon character's.
"Speak for yourself, Mickey,"
Ted squeaked.
"I thought I saw a footy tap,"
Norman said. They were both laughing, hearing their voices.
"Knock it off, you guys," Barnes said over the intercom. "This is serious."
"Yes, sir, Captain,"
Ted said, but by now his voice was so high-pitched that it was almost unintelligible, and they fell into laughter again. Their tinny voices, like those of schoolgirls reverberating inside the steel cylinder. Helium made their voices high and squeaky, but it also had other effects.
"Getting chilled, boys?"
Barnes said. They were indeed getting colder. He saw Ted shivering, felt goosebumps on his own legs. It felt as if a wind were blowing across their bodies, except there wasn't any wind. The lightness of the helium increased evaporation, made them cold. Across the cylinder, Ted said something, but Norman couldn't understand Ted at all anymore. His voice was too high-pitched to be comprehensible. It was just a thin squeal.
"Sounds like a couple of rats in there now," Barnes said, with satisfaction.
Ted rolled his eyes toward the loudspeaker and squeaked something.
"If you want to talk, get a talker," Barnes said. "You'll find them in the locker under the seat."
Norman found a metal locker, clicked it open. The metal squealed loudly, like chalk on a blackboard. All the sounds in the chamber were high-pitched. Inside the locker, he saw two black plastic pads with neck straps.
"Just slip them over your neck. Put the pad at the base of your throat."
"Okay," Ted said, and then blinked in surprise. His voice sounded slightly rough, but otherwise normal. "These things must change the vocal cord frequencies," Norman said.
"Why don't you guys pay attention to briefings?" Barnes said. "That's exactly what they do. You'll have to wear a talker all the time you're down here, at least if you want anybody to understand you. Still cold?"
"Yes," Ted said.
"Well, hang on. You're almost fully pressurized now."
Then there was another hiss, and a side door slid open. Barnes stood there with light jackets over his arm.
"Welcome to DH-8, he said.
DH-8. You're the last to arrive, Barnes said. We just have time for a quick tour before we open the spacecraft.
You're ready to open it now?
Ted asked. Wonderful. I've just been talking about this with Norman. This is such a great moment, our first contact with alien life. We ought to prepare a little speech for when we open it up. There'll be time to consider that, Barnes said, with an odd glance at Ted. I'll show you the habitat first, this way. He explained that the DH-8 habitat consisted of 5 large cylinders, designated A to E. Sill A is the airlock where we are now. He led them into an adjacent changing room. Heavy cloth suits hung limply on the wall, alongside yellow sculpted helmets of the sort Norman had seen the divers wearing. The helmets had a futuristic look. Norman tapped one with his knuckles. It was plastic and surprisingly light. He saw Johnson stenciled above one faceplate. "We going to wear these?" Norman asked. "That's correct," Barnes said.
"Then we'll be going outside?"
Norman said, feeling a twinge of alarm. "Eventually, yes. Don't worry about it now. Still cold?" They were. Barnes had them change into tight-fitting jumpsuits of clinging blue polyester. Ted frowned. "Don't you think these look a little silly?" "They may not be the height of fashion," Barnes said, "but they prevent heat loss from helium." "The color is unflattering," Ted said. "Screw the color," Barnes said. He handed them lightweight jackets. Norman felt something heavy in one pocket and pulled out a battery pack. "The jackets are wired and electrically heated," Barnes said, "like an electric blanket, which is what you'll use for sleeping. Follow me." They went on to Sill B, which housed power and life support systems. At first glance, it looked like a large boiler room, all multicolored pipes and utilitarian fittings. "This is where we generate all of our heat, power, and air," Barnes said. He pointed out the features. "Closed cycle IC generator, 24110, hydrogen and oxygen-driven fuel cells, LSS monitors, liquid processor runs on silver-zinc batteries. And that's Chief Petty Officer Fletcher. Teeny Fletcher." Norman saw a big-boned figure working back among the pipes with a heavy wrench. The figure turned. Alice Fletcher gave them a grin, waved a greasy hand. "She seems to know what she's doing," Ted said approvingly. "She does," Barnes said. "But all the major support systems are redundant. Fletcher is just our final redundancy. Actually, you'll find the entire habitat is self-regulating." He clipped heavy badges onto the jumpsuits. "Wear these at all times, even though they're just a precaution. The alarms trigger automatically if life support conditions go below optimum. But that won't happen. There are sensors in each room of the habitat. You'll get used to the fact that the environment continually adjusts to your presence. Lights will go on and off, heat lamps will turn on and off, and air vents will hiss to keep track of things. It's all automatic, don't sweat it. Every single major system is redundant. We can lose power, we can lose air, we can lose water entirely, and we will be fine for 130 hours. 130 hours didn't sound very long to Norman. He did the calculation in his head. 5 days. 5 days didn't seem very long either. They went into the next cylinder, the lights clicking on as they entered. Cylinder C contained living quarters, bunks, toilets, showers, plenty of hot water, you'll find. Barnes showed them around proudly, as if it were a hotel. The living quarters were heavily insulated. Carpeted deck, walls, and ceilings, all covered in soft padded foam, which made the interior appear like an overstuffed couch. But despite the bright colors and the evident care in decoration, Norman still found it cramped and dreary. The portholes were tiny, and they revealed only the blackness of the ocean outside. And wherever the padding ended, he saw heavy bolts and heavy steel plating, a reminder of where they really were. He felt as if he were inside a large iron lung, and he thought, that isn't so far wrong. They ducked through narrow bulkheads into D-Sill, a small laboratory with benches and microscopes on the top level, a compact electronics unit on the level below. "This is Tina Chan," Barnes said, introducing a very still woman. They all shook hands. Norman thought that Tina Chan was almost unnaturally calm, until he realized she was one of those people who almost never blinked their eyes. "Be nice to Tina," Barnes was saying.
She's our only link to the outside. She runs the comm ops and the sensor systems as well. In fact, all the electronics. Tina Chan was surrounded by the bulkiest monitors Norman had ever seen. They looked like TV sets from the 1950s. Barnes explained that certain equipment didn't do well in the helium atmosphere, including TV tubes. In the early days of undersea habitats, the tubes had to be replaced daily. Now they were elaborately coated and shielded, hence their bulk. Next to Chan was another woman, Jane Edmonds, whom Barnes introduced as the unit archivist. "What's a unit archivist?" Ted asked her. "Petty Officer First Class Data Processing, sir," she said formally. Jane Edmonds wore spectacles and stood stiffly. She reminded Norman of a librarian. "Data processing?" Ted said. "My mission is to keep all the digital recordings, visual materials, and videotapes, sir. Every aspect of this historic moment is being recorded, and I keep everything neatly filed." Norman thought, "She is a librarian."
"Oh, excellent," Ted said.
"I'm glad to hear it. Film or tape?"
"Tape, sir."
"I know my way around a video camera," Ted said with a smile. "What are you putting it down on, half inch or three quarter?"
"Sir, we use a data scan image equivalent of 2,000 pixels per side-biased frame, each pixel carrying a 12-tone grayscale."
"Oh," Ted said.
"It's a bit better than commercial systems you may be familiar with, sir."
"I see," Ted said, but he recovered smoothly and chatted with Edmonds for a while about technical matters.
"Ted seems awfully interested in how we're going to record this," Barnes said, looking uneasy.
"Yes, he seems to be." Norman wondered why that troubled Barnes. Was Barnes worried about the visual record? Or did he think Ted would try to hog the show? Would Ted try to hog the show? Did Barnes have any worries about having this appear to be a civilian operation?
"No, the exterior lights are 150-watt quartz halogen," Edmonds was saying. "We're recording at equivalent of 500,000 ASA, so that's ample. The real problem is backscatter. We're constantly fighting it."
Norman said, "I noticed your support team is all women."
"Yes," Barnes said. "All the deep diving studies show that women are superior for submerged operations. They're physically smaller and consume less nutrients and air. They have better social skills and tolerate close quarters better. And they are physiologically tougher and have better endurance. The fact is, the Navy long ago recognized that all their submariners should be female."
He laughed.
"But just try to implement that one."
He glanced at his watch.
"We'd better move on, Ted."
They went on. The final cylinder, E-Sill, was more spacious than the others. There were magazines, a television, and a large lounge. And on the deck below was an efficient mess and a kitchen. Seaman Rose Levy, the cook, was a red-faced woman with a southern accent, standing beneath giant suction fans. She asked Norman whether he had any favorite desserts.
"Desserts?"
"Yes, sir, Dr. Johnson. I like to make everybody's favorite dessert if I can."
"What about you? You have a favorite, Dr. Fielding?"
"Key lime pie," Ted said. "I love key lime pie."
"Can do, sir,"
Levy said with a big smile. She turned back to Norman.
"I haven't heard yours yet, Dr. Johnson."
"Strawberry shortcake."
"Easy.
Got some nice New Zealand strawberries coming down on the last sub shuttle. Maybe you'd like that shortcake tonight?"
"Why not, Rose?" Barnes said heartily.
Norman looked out the black porthole window. From the portholes of D-Sill, he could see the rectangular illuminated grid that extended across the bottom, following the half-mile-long buried spacecraft. Divers, illuminated like fireflies, moved over the glowing grid surface. Norman thought, "I am 1,000 feet beneath the surface of the ocean, and we are talking about whether we should have strawberry shortcake for dessert." But the more he thought about it, the more it made sense. The best way to make somebody comfortable in a new environment was to give him familiar food.
"Strawberries make me break out," Ted said.
"I'll make your shortcake with blueberries," Levy said, not missing a beat.
"And whipped cream?" Ted said.
"Well,
you can't have everything," Barnes said. "And one of the things you can't have at 30 atmospheres of mixed gas is whipped cream. Won't whip. Let's move on."
Beth and Harry were waiting in the small padded conference room directly above the mess. They both wore jumpsuits and heated jackets. Harry was shaking his head as they arrived. "Like our padded cell?" He poked the insulated walls. "It's like living in a vagina." Beth said, "Don't you like going back to the womb, Harry?" "No," Harry said. "I've been there. Once was enough." "These jumpsuits are pretty bad," Ted said, plucking at the clinging polyester. "Shows your belly nicely," Harry said. "Let's settle down," Barnes said. "A few sequins, you could be Elvis Presley," Harry said.
"Elvis Presley's dead."
"Now's your chance," Harry said. Norman looked around. "Where's Levine?" "Levine didn't make it," Barnes said briskly. "He got claustrophobic in the sub coming down and had to be taken back. One of those things."
"Then we have no marine biologist?"
"We'll manage without him."
"I hate this damn jumpsuit," Ted said. "I really hate it."
"Beth looks good in hers."
"Yes, Beth works out."
"And it's damp in here, too," Ted said. "Is it always so damp?"
Norman had noticed that humidity was a problem. Everything they touched felt slightly wet and clammy and cold. Barnes warned them of the danger of infections and minor colds and handed out bottles of skin lotion and eardrops.
"I thought you said the technology was all worked out," Harry said.
"It is," Barnes said. "Believe me, this is plush compared to the habitats 10 years ago."
10 years ago," Harry said, "they stopped making habitats because people kept dying in them."
Barnes frowned. "There was one accident."
"There were two accidents," Harry said. "A total of 4 people.
"Special circumstances," Barnes said, "not involving Navy technology or personnel."
"Great," Harry said. "How long did you say we were going to be down here?"
"Maximum 72 hours, Barnes said.
"You sure about that?"
"It's Navy regs," Barnes said.
"Why?" Norman asked, puzzled.
Barnes shook his head. "Never," he said, "never ask a reason for Navy regulations."
The intercom clicked, and Tina Chan said, "Captain Barnes, we have a signal from the divers. They are mounting the airlock now. Another few minutes to open." The feeling in the room changed immediately. The excitement was palpable. Ted rubbed his hands together. He realized, of course, that even without opening that spacecraft, we have already made a major discovery of profound importance.
"What's that?" Norman said.
"We've shot the unique event hypothesis to hell," Ted said, glancing at Beth.
"The unique event hypothesis?" Barnes said.
"He's referring," Beth said, "to the fact that physicists and chemists tend to believe in intelligent extraterrestrial life, while biologists tend not to. Many biologists feel the development of intelligent life on Earth required so many peculiar steps that it represents a unique event in the universe that may never have occurred elsewhere."
"Wouldn't intelligence arise again and again?" Barnes said.
"Well, it barely arose on the Earth," Beth said. "The Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and single-celled life appeared 3.9 billion years ago, almost immediately, geologically speaking. But life remained single-celled for the next 3 billion years. Then in the Cambrian period, around 600 million years ago, there was an explosion of sophisticated life forms. Within 100 million years, the ocean was full of fish. Then the land became populated, then the air. But nobody knows why the explosion occurred in the first place. And since it didn't occur for 3 billion years, there's the possibility that on some other planet it might never occur at all. And even after the Cambrian, the chain of events leading to man appears to be so special, so chancy, that biologists worry it might never have happened. Just consider the fact that if the dinosaurs hadn't been wiped out 65 million years ago by a comet or whatever, then reptiles might still be the dominant form on Earth, and mammals would never have had a chance to take over. No mammals, no primates. No primates, no apes. No apes, no man. There are a lot of random factors in evolution. A lot of luck. That's why biologists think intelligent life might be a unique event in the universe, only occurring here."
"Except now," Ted said, "we know it's not a unique event, because there is a damn big spacecraft out there."
"Personally," Beth said, "I couldn't be more pleased." She bit her lip.
"You don't look pleased," Norman said.
"I tell you," Beth said, "I can't help being nervous.
10 years ago, Bill Jackson at Stanford ran a series of weekend seminars on extraterrestrial life. This was right after he won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. He split us into two groups. One group designed the alien life form and worked it all out scientifically. The other group tried to figure out the life form and communicate with it. Jackson presided over the whole thing as a hard scientist, not letting anybody get carried away. One time we brought in a sketch of a proposed creature, and he said, very tough, "Okay, where's the anus?" That was his criticism. But many animals on Earth have no anus. There are all kinds of excretory mechanisms that don't require a special orifice. Jackson assumed an anus was necessary, but it isn't. And now? She shrugged. Who knows what we'll find? We'll know soon enough, Ted said. The intercom clicked. Captain Barnes, the divers have the airlock mounted in place. The robot is now ready to enter the spacecraft. Ted said, what robot? The door. I don't think it's appropriate at all, Ted said angrily. We came down here to make a manned entry into this alien spacecraft. I think we should do what we came here to do, make a manned entry. Absolutely not, Barnes said. We can't risk it. You must think of this, Ted said, as an archaeological site. Greater than Chichen Itza, greater than Troy, greater than Tutankhamun's tomb. Unquestionably the most important archaeological site in the history of mankind. Do you really intend to have a damned robot open that site? Where's your sense of human destiny?
Where's your sense of self-preservation? Barnes said.
I strongly object, Captain Barnes.
Duly noted, Barnes said, turning away. Now let's get on with it. Tina, give us the video feed. Ted sputtered, but he fell silent as two large monitors in front of them clicked on. On the left screen, they saw the complex tubular metal scaffolding of the robot, with exposed motors and gears. The robot was positioned before the curved gray metal wall of the spacecraft. Within that wall was a door that looked rather like an airliner door. The second screen gave a closer view of the door, taken by the video camera mounted on the robot itself. It's rather similar to an airplane door, Ted said. Norman glanced at Harry, who smiled enigmatically. Then he looked at Barnes. Barnes did not appear surprised. Barnes already knew about the door, he realized. I wonder how we can account for such parallelism in door design, Ted said. The likelihood of its occurring by chance is astronomically small. Why, this door is the perfect size and shape for a human being.
That's right, Harry said.
It's incredible, Ted said. Quite incredible.
Harry smiled, said nothing. Barnes said, let's find control surfaces. The robot video scanner moved left and right across the spacecraft hull. It stopped on the image of a rectangular panel mounted to the left of the door.
Can you open that panel?
Working on it now, sir. Whirring, the robot claw extended out toward the panel. But the claw was clumsy. It scraped against the metal, leaving a series of gleaming scratches. But the panel remained closed.
Ridiculous, Ted said. It's like watching a baby.
The claw continued to scratch at the panel.
We should be doing this ourselves, Ted said.
Use suction, Barnes said.
Another arm extended out with a rubber sucker.
Ah, the plumber's friend, Ted said disdainfully.
As they watched, the sucker attached to the panel flattened. Then, with a click, the panel lifted open.
At last! I can't see.
The view inside the panel was blurred, out of focus. They could distinguish what appeared to be a series of colored, round, metal protrusions, red, yellow, and blue. There were also intricate black and white symbols above the knobs.
Look, Ted said. Red, blue, yellow, primary colors. This is a very big break.
Why? Norman said.
Because it suggests that the aliens have the same sensory equipment that we do. They may see the universe the same way, visually, in the same colors, utilizing the same part of the electromagnetic spectrum. That's going to help immeasurably in making contact with them. And those black and white markings? That must be some of their writing. Can you imagine? Alien writing.
He smiled enthusiastically. This is a great moment, he said. I feel truly privileged to be here.
Focus,
Barnes called. Focusing now, sir. The image became even more blurred.
No, the other way.
Yes, sir, focusing now. The image changed, slowly resolved into sharp focus.
Uh-oh, Ted said, staring at the screen. They now saw that the blurred knobs were actually three colored buttons, yellow, red, and blue. The buttons were each an inch in diameter and had knurled or machined edges. The symbols above the buttons resolved sharply into a series of neatly stenciled labels. From left to right, the labels read, Emergency Ready, Emergency Lock, and Emergency Open. In English. There was a moment of stunned silence. And then, very softly, Harry Adams began to laugh. The spacecraft.
That's English, Ted said, staring at the screen. Written English.
Yeah, Harry said. Sure is.
What's going on? Ted said. Is this some kind of joke?
No, Harry said. He was calm, oddly detached.
How could this spacecraft be 300 years old and carry instructions in modern English?
Think about it, Harry said. Ted frowned.
Maybe, he said, this alien spacecraft is somehow presenting itself to us in a way that will make us comfortable.
Think about it some more, Harry said. There was a short silence.
Well, if it is an alien spacecraft...
It's not an alien spacecraft, Harry said. There was another silence. Then Ted said,
Well, why don't you just tell us all what it is, since you're so sure of yourself?
All right, Harry said. It's an American spacecraft.
An American spacecraft? Half a mile long, made with technology we don't have yet, and buried for 300 years?
Of course, Harry said. It's been obvious from the start. Right, Captain Barnes?
We had considered it, Barnes admitted. The President had considered it.
That's why you didn't inform the Russians.
Exactly.
By now, Ted was completely frustrated. He clenched his fists as if he wanted to hit someone. He looked from one person to another.
But how did you know?
The first clue, Harry said, came from the condition of the craft itself. It shows no damage whatever. Its condition is pristine. Yet any spacecraft that crashes in water will be damaged. Even at low entry velocities, say 200 miles an hour, the surface of water is as hard as concrete. No matter how strong this craft is, you would expect some degree of damage from the impact with the water. Yet it has no damage.
Meaning?
Meaning it didn't land in the water.
I don't understand. It must have flown here.
It didn't fly here. It arrived here.
From where?
From the future, Harry said. This is some kind of Earth craft that was, will be, made in the future, and has traveled backward in time and appeared under our ocean several hundred years ago.
Why would people in the future do that?
Ted groaned. He was clearly unhappy to be deprived of his alien craft, his great historical moment. He slumped in a chair and stared dully at the monitor screens.
I don't know why people in the future would do that, Harry said. We're not there yet.
Maybe it was an accident, unintended.
Let's go ahead and open it up, Barnes said.
Opening, sir. The robot hand moved forward toward the open button. The hand pressed several times. There was a clanking sound, but nothing happened.
What's wrong? Barnes said.
Sir, we're not able to impact the button. The extensor arm is too large to fit inside the panel.
Great.
Shall I try the probe?
Try the probe.
The claw hand moved back, and a thin needle probe extended out toward the button. The probe slid forward, adjusted position delicately, touched the button. It pushed and slipped off.
Trying again, sir.
The probe again pressed the button and again slid off.
Sir, the surface is too slippery.
Keep trying.
You know, Ted said thoughtfully, this is still a remarkable situation. In one sense, it's even more remarkable than contact with extraterrestrials. I was already quite certain that extraterrestrial life exists in the universe, but time travel?
Frankly, as an astrophysicist, I had my doubts. From everything we know, it's impossible, contradicted by the laws of physics. And yet, now we have proof that time travel is possible, and that our own species will do it in the future. Ted was smiling, wide-eyed and happy again. You had to admire him, Norman thought. He was so wonderfully irrepressible.
And here we are, Ted said, on the threshold of our first contact with our species from the future. Think of it. We are going to meet ourselves from some future time.
The probe pressed again and again, without success.
Sir, we cannot impact the button.
I see that, Barnes said, standing up. Okay, shut it down and get it out of there. Ted, looks like you're going to get your wish after all. We'll have to go in and open it up manually. Let's suit up. Into the ship. In the changing room in Cylinder A, Norman stepped into his suit. Tina and Edmonds helped fit the helmet over his head and snap-locked the ring at the neck. He felt the heavy weight of the rebreather tanks on his back. The straps pressed into his shoulder. He tasted metallic air. There was a crackle as his helmet intercom came on. The first words he heard were, "What about at the threshold of a great opportunity for the human species?" Norman laughed, grateful for the break in the tension. "You find it funny?" Ted asked, offended. Norman looked across the room at the suited man with Fielding stenciled on his yellow helmet. "No," Norman said, "I'm just nervous."
"Me too," Beth said.
"Nothing to it," Barnes said. "Trust me." "What are the three biggest lies in DH-8? Harry said, and they laughed again. They crowded together into the tiny airlock, bumping helmeted heads, and the bulkhead hatch to the left was sealed, the wheel spinning. Barnes said, "Okay, folks, just breathe easy." He opened the lower hatch, exposing black water. The water did not rise into the compartment. "The habitat's on positive pressure," Barnes said. "The level won't come up. Now watch me and do this the way I do. You don't want to tear your suit." Moving awkwardly with the weight of the tanks, he crouched down by the hatch, gripped the side handholds, and let go, disappearing with a soft splash. One by one, they dropped down to the floor of the ocean. Norman gasped as near-freezing water enveloped his suit. Immediately, he heard the hum of a tiny fan as the electrical heaters in his suit activated. His feet touched soft, muddy ground. He looked around in the darkness. He was standing beneath the habitat. Directly ahead, 100 yards away, was the glowing rectangular grid. Barnes was already striding forward, leaning into the current, moving slowly like a man on the moon.
"Isn't this fantastic?"
"Calm down, Ted," Harry said. Beth said, "Actually, it's odd how little life there is down here. Have you noticed? Not a sea fan, not a slug, not a sponge, not a solitary fish. Nothing but empty brown seafloor. This must be one of those dead spots in the Pacific." A bright light came on behind him. Norman's own shadow was cast forward on the bottom. He looked back and saw Edmonds holding a camera and light in a bulky waterproof housing. "We recording all this?"
"Yes, sir."
"Try not to fall down, Norman," Beth laughed. "I'm trying." They were closer now to the grid. Norman felt better seeing the other divers working there. To the right was the high fin, extending out of the coral, an enormous, smooth, dark surface dwarfing them as it rose toward the surface. Barnes led them past the fin and down into a tunnel cut in the coral. The tunnel was 60 feet long, narrow, strung with lights. They walked single file. It felt like going down into a mine, Norman thought. "This what the divers cut?" "That's right." Norman saw a boxy, corrugated steel structure surrounded by pressure tanks. "Airlock ahead. We're almost there," Barnes said. "Everybody okay?" "So far," Harry said. They entered the airlock, and Barnes closed the door. Air hissed loudly. Norman watched the water recede down past his faceplate, then his waist, his knees, then to the floor. The hissing stopped, and they passed through another door, sealing it behind them. Norman turned to the metal hull of the spaceship. The robot had been moved aside.
Norman felt very much as if he were standing alongside a big jetliner, a curved metal surface, and a flush door. The metal was a dull gray, which gave it an ominous quality. Despite himself, Norman was nervous. Listening to the way the others were breathing, he sensed they were nervous, too.
Okay, Barnes said. Everybody here?
Edmund said, wait for video, please, sir.
Okay, waiting.
They all lined up beside the door, but they still had their helmets on. It wasn't going to be much of a picture, Norman thought. Edmund's, tape is running.
Ted, I'd like to say a few words.
Harry,
Jesus, Ted, can't you ever let up?
Ted, I think it's important.
Harry,
go ahead, make your speech.
Ted, hello, this is Ted Fielding, here at the door of the unknown spacecraft which has been discovered.
Barnes, wait a minute, Ted.
Here at the door of the unknown spacecraft sounds like here at the tomb of the unknown soldier.
Ted, you don't like it?
Barnes,
well, I think it has the wrong associations.
Ted, I thought you would like it.
Beth,
can we just get on with it, please?
Ted, never mind.
Harry,
what, are you going to pout now?
Ted, never mind. We'll do without any commentary on this historic moment.
Harry,
okay, fine. Let's get it open.
Ted, I think everybody knows how I feel. I feel that we should have some brief remarks for posterity.
Harry,
well, make your goddamn remarks.
Ted,
listen, you son of a bitch. I've had about enough of your superior know-it-all attitude.
Barnes,
stop tape, please.
Edmunds,
tape is stopped, sir.
Barnes,
let's everyone settle down.
Harry,
I consider all this ceremony utterly irrelevant.
Ted,
well, it's not irrelevant. It's appropriate.
Barnes, all right, I'll do it. Roll the tape.
Edmunds,
tape is rolling.
Barnes,
this is Captain Barnes. We are now about to open the hatch cover. Present with me on this historic occasion are Ted Fielding, Norman Johnson, Beth Halpern, and Harry Adams.
Harry,
why am I last?
Barnes,
I did it left to right, Harry.
Harry,
isn't it funny the only black man is named last?
Barnes,
Harry, it's left to right the way we're standing here.
Harry,
and after the only woman.
I'm a full professor. Beth is only an assistant professor.
Beth,
Harry,
Ted, you know how... Perhaps we should be identified by our full titles and institutional affiliations.
Harry,
what's wrong with alphabetical order?
Barnes,
that's it. Forget it. No tape.
Edmunds,
tape is off, sir.
Barnes,
Jesus Christ.
He turned away from the group, shaking his helmeted head. He flipped up the metal plate, exposed the two buttons, and pushed one. A yellow light blinked. Ready.
Everybody stay on internal air,
Barnes said. They all continued to breathe from their tanks, in case the interior gases in the spacecraft were toxic.
Everybody ready?
Ready.
Barnes pushed the button marked open. With a rumble, the door slid open sideways, just like an airplane door. For a moment, Norman could see nothing but blackness beyond. They moved forward cautiously, shone their lights through the open door, saw girders, a complex of metal tubes.
Check the air, Beth.
Beth pulled the plunger on a small gas monitor in her hand. The readout screen glowed. Nitrogen, oxygen, trace CO2 and water vapor. The right proportions. It's Earth atmosphere.
Contaminants?
No.
Okay. One at a time.
Barnes removed his helmet first, breathed the air.
It seems okay. Metallic, a slight tingle, but okay.
He took a few deep breaths, then nodded. The others removed their helmets, set them on the deck.
That's better.
Shall we go?
Why not?
There was a brief hesitation, and then Beth stepped through quickly. Ladies first. The others followed her. Norman glanced back, saw all their yellow helmets lying on the floor. Edmunds, holding the video camera to her eye, said, "Go ahead, Dr. Johnson." Norman turned and stepped into the spacecraft. Interior. They stood on a catwalk 5 feet wide, suspended high in the air.
Norman shone his flashlight down. The beam glowed through 40 feet of darkness before it splashed on the lower hull. Surrounding them, dimly visible in the darkness, was a dense network of struts and girders. Beth said, "It's like being in an oil refinery." She shone her light on one steel beam. Stenciled was AVR-09. All the stenciling was in English. "Most of what you see is structural," Barnes said. "Cross-stress bracing for the outer hull gives tremendous support along all axes. The ship is very ruggedly built, as we suspected, designed to take extraordinary stresses. There's probably another hull further in." Norman was reminded that Barnes had once been an aeronautical engineer. "Not only that," Harry said, shining his light on the outer hull. "Look at this, a layer of lead." "Radiation shield?" "Must be. It's 6 inches thick." "So this ship was built to handle a lot of radiation." "A hell of a lot," Harry said. There was a haze in the ship, and a faintly oily feel to the air. The metal girders seemed to be coated in oil, but when Norman touched them, the oil didn't come off on his fingers. He realized that the metal itself had an unusual texture. It was slick and slightly soft to the touch, almost rubbery. "Interesting," Ted said. "Some kind of new material. We associate strength with hardness, but this metal, if it is metal, is both strong and soft. Materials technology is obviously advanced since our day." "Obviously," Harry said. "Well, it makes sense," Ted said. "If you think of America 50 years ago as compared with today, one of the biggest changes is the great variety of plastics and ceramics we have now that were not even imagined back then." Ted continued to talk, his voice echoing in the cavernous darkness. But Norman could hear the tension in his voice. Ted's whistling in the dark, he thought. They moved deeper into the ship. Norman felt dizzy to be so high in the gloom. They came to a branch point in the catwalk. It was hard to see with all the pipes and struts, like being in a forest of metal. "Which way?" Barnes had a wrist compass. It glowed green. "Go right." They followed the network of catwalks for 10 minutes more. Gradually, Norman could see that Barnes was right. There was a central cylinder constructed within the outer cylinder and held away from it by a dense arrangement of girders and supports. A spacecraft within a spacecraft. Why would they build the ship like this?
You'd have to ask them.
The reasons must have been compelling, Barnes said. The power requirements for a double hull with so much lead shielding. Hard to imagine the engine you'd need to make something this big fly. After 3 or 4 minutes, they arrived at the door on the inner hull. It looked like the outer door. Breathers back on? I don't know. Can we risk it? Without waiting, Beth flipped up the panel of buttons, pressed open, and the door rumbled open. More darkness beyond. They stepped through. Norman felt softness underfoot. He shined his light down on beige carpeting. Their flashlights crisscrossed the room, revealing a large, contoured beige console with 3 high-backed padded seats. The room was clearly built for human beings. Must be the bridge or the cockpit. But the curved consoles were completely blank. There was no instrumentation of any kind, and the seats were empty. They swung their beams back and forth in the darkness. Looks like a mock-up rather than the real thing. It can't be a mock-up. Well, it looks like one. Norman ran his hand over the smooth contours of the console. It was nicely molded, pleasant to feel. Norman pressed the surface, felt it bend to his touch, rubbery again. Another new material. Norman's flashlight showed a few artifacts. Taped to the far end of the console was a hand-marked sign on a 3x5 filing card. It said, "Go, baby, go." Nearby was a small plastic statuette of a cute animal that looked like a purple squirrel. The base said, "Lucky Lementina," whatever that meant. These seats leather? Looks like it. Where are the damned controls? Norman continued to poke at the blank console, and suddenly the beige console surface took on depth.
and appeared to contain instruments, screens. All the instrumentation was somehow within the surface of the console, like an optical illusion or a hologram. Norman read the lettering above the instruments. Pause thrusters, F3 piston booster, glider, sieves. More new technology, Ted said. Reminiscent of liquid crystals, but far superior. Some kind of advanced optoelectronics. Suddenly, all the console screens glowed red, and there was a beeping sound. Startled, Norman jumped back. The control panel was coming to life. Watch it, everybody. A single, bright, lightning flash of intense white light filled the room, leaving a harsh afterimage. Oh, God! Another flash, and another. And then the ceiling lights came on, evenly illuminating the room. Norman saw startled, frightened faces. He sighed, exhaling slowly. Jesus!
How the hell did that happen? Barnes said.
It was me, Beth said. I pushed this button.
Let's not go around pushing buttons, if you don't mind, Barnes said irritably.
It was marked room lights. It seemed an appropriate thing to do.
Let's try to stay together on this, Barnes said.
Well, Jesus, Hal.
Just don't push any more buttons, Beth.
They were moving around the cabin, looking at the instrument panel, at the chairs. All of them, that is, all except for Harry. He stood very still in the middle of the room, not moving, and said, Anybody see a date anywhere? No date. There's got to be a date, Harry said, suddenly tense, and we've got to find it, because this is definitely an American spaceship from the future. What's it doing here? Norman asked. Damned if I know, Harry said. He shrugged. Norman frowned. What's wrong, Harry? Nothing.
Sure?
Yeah, sure.
Norman thought, he's figured out something, and it bothers him, but he's not saying what it is.
Ted said, So this is what a time travel machine looks like.
I don't know, Barnes said. If you ask me, this instrument panel looks like it's for flying, and this room looks like a flight deck.
Norman thought so, too. Everything about the room reminded him of an airplane cockpit. The three chairs for pilot, co-pilot, navigator. The layout of the instrumentation. This was a machine that flew, he was sure of it. Yet, something was odd. He slipped into one of the contoured chairs. The soft, leather-like material was almost too comfortable. He heard a gurgling. Water inside?
I hope you're not going to fly this sucker, Ted laughed.
No, no. What's that whirring noise? The chair gripped him. Norman had an instant of panic, feeling the chair move all around his body, squeezing his shoulders, wrapping around his hips. The leather padding slid around his head, covering his ears, drawing down over his forehead. He was sinking deeper, disappearing inside the chair itself, being swallowed up by it. Oh, God. And then the chair snapped forward, pulling up tight before the control console. And the whirring stopped. Then, nothing.
I think, Beth said, that the chair thinks you are going to fly it.
Norman said, trying to control his breathing, his racing pulse. I wonder how I get out. The only part of his body still free were his hands. He moved his fingers, felt a panel of buttons on the arms of the chair. He pressed one. The chair slid back, opened like a soft clam, released him. Norman climbed out and looked back at the imprint of his body, slowly disappearing as the chair whirred and adjusted itself. Harry poked one of the leather pads experimentally, heard the gurgle. Water filled.
Makes perfect sense, Barnes said. Water's not compressible. You can withstand enormous G-forces sitting in a chair like this.
And the ship itself is built to take great strains, Ted said. Maybe time travel is strenuous? Structurally strenuous?
Maybe, Norman was doubtful. But I think Barnes is right. This is a machine that flew.
Perhaps it just looks that way, Ted said. After all, we know how to travel in space, but we don't know how to travel in time. We know that space and time are really aspects of the same thing, space-time.
Perhaps you're required to fly in time just the way you fly in space. Maybe time travel and space travel are more similar than we think now.
Aren't we forgetting something? Beth said. Where is everybody? If people flew this thing in either time or space, where are they?
Probably somewhere else on the ship.
I'm not so sure, Harry said.
Look at this leather on these seats. It's brand new.
Maybe it was a new ship.
No, I mean really brand new. This leather doesn't show any scratches, any cuts, any coffee cup spills or stains. There is nothing to suggest that these seats have ever been sat in.
Maybe there wasn't any crew.
Why would you have seats if there wasn't any crew?
Maybe they took the crew out at the last minute. It seems they were worried about radiation. The inner hull's lead-shielded, too.
Why should there be radiation associated with time travel?
I know, Ted said. Maybe the ship got launched by accident. Maybe the ship was on the launch pad and somebody pressed the button before the crew got aboard so the ship took off empty.
You mean, oops, wrong button?
That'd be a hell of a mistake, Norman said.
Barnes shook his head. I'm not buying it. For one thing, a ship this big could never be launched from Earth. It had to be built and assembled in orbit and launched from space.
What do you make of this? Beth said, pointing to another console near the rear of the flight deck. There was a fourth chair, drawn up close to the console. The leather was wrapped around a human form.
No kidding.
There's a man in there?
Let's have a look.
Beth pushed the armrest buttons. The chair whirred back from the console and unwrapped itself. They saw a man staring forward, his eyes open.
My God! After all these years, perfectly preserved, Ted said.
You would expect that, Harry said, considering he's a mannequin.
But he's so lifelike.
Give our descendants some credit for advances, Harry said. They're half a century ahead of us. He pushed the mannequin forward, exposing an umbilicus running out the back at the base of the hips.
Wires. Not wires, Ted said. Glass. Optical cables. This whole ship uses optical technology and not electronics.
In any case, it's one mystery solved, Harry said, looking at the dummy. Obviously, this craft was built to be a manned ship, but it was sent out unmanned.
Why?
Probably the intended voyage was too dangerous. They sent an unmanned vessel first before they sent a manned vessel. Beth said, and where did they send it? With time travel, you don't send it to a where, you send it to a when.
Okay, then to when did they send it?
Harry shrugged.
No information yet, he said.
That diffidence again, Norman thought. What was Harry really thinking?
Well, this craft is half a mile long, Barnes said. We have a lot more to see.
I wonder if they had a flight recorder, Norman said.
You mean like a commercial airliner?
Yes, yeah, something to record the activity of the ship on its voyage.
They must have, Harry said.
Trace the dummy cable back, you're sure to find it. I'd like to see that recorder, too. In fact, I would say it is crucial.
Norman was looking at the console, lifting up a keyboard panel.
Look here, he said.
I found a date.
They clustered around. There was a stamp in the plastic beneath the keyboard. Intel Inc., made in USA. Serial number 98004077-8543. August 5th, 2043?
Looks like it.
So we're walking through a ship 50-odd years before it's going to be built. This is giving me a headache.
Look here.
Beth had moved forward from the console deck into what looked like living quarters. There were 20 bunk beds.
Crew of 20?
If it took 3 people to fly it, what were the other 17 for?
Nobody had an answer to that.
Next, they entered a large kitchen, a toilet, living quarters. Everything was new and sleekly designed, but recognizable for what it was. You know, Hal, this is a lot more comfortable than DH-8.
Yes, maybe we should move in here.
Absolutely not, Barnes said. We're studying this ship, not living in it. We've got a lot more work to do before we even begin to know what this is all about.
It'd be more efficient to live here while we explore it.
I don't want to live here, Harry said. It gives me the creeps.
Me too, Beth said.
They had been aboard the ship for an hour now, and Norman's feet hurt. That was another thing he hadn't anticipated. While exploring a large spacecraft from the future, your feet could begin to hurt. But Barnes continued on. Leaving the crew quarters, they entered a vast area of narrow walkways set out between great sealed compartments that stretched ahead as far as they could see. The compartments turned out to be storage bays of immense size. They opened one bay and found it was filled with heavy plastic containers, which looked rather like the loading containers of contemporary airliners, except many times larger. They opened one container.
No kidding, Barnes said, peering inside. What is it? Food.
The food was wrapped in layers of lead foil and plastic, like NASA rations. Ted picked one up.
Food from the future, he said, and smacked his lips.
You going to eat that? Harry said.
Absolutely, Ted said. You know, I once had a bottle of Dom Perignon 1897, but this will be the first time I've ever had anything to eat from the future, from 2043.
It's also 300 years old, Harry said. Maybe you'll want to film this, Ted said to Edmonds. Me eating. Edmonds dutifully put the camera to her eye, flicked on the light. Let's not do that now, Barnes said. We have other things to accomplish.
This is human interest, Ted said.
Not now, Barnes said firmly. He opened a second storage container, and a third. They all contained food. They moved to the next storage bay and opened more containers.
It's all food, nothing but food.
The ship had traveled with an enormous amount of food. Even allowing for a crew of 20, it was enough food for a voyage of several years. They were getting very tired. It was a relief when Beth found a button, said, I wonder what this does. Barnes said, Beth, and the walkway began to move, rubber tread rolling forward with a slight hum. Beth, I want you to stop pushing every damn button you see. But nobody else objected. It was a relief to ride the walkway past dozens of identical storage bays. Finally, they came to a new section, much farther forward. Norman guessed by now they were a quarter of a mile from the crew compartment in the back. That meant they were roughly in the middle of the huge ship. And here they found a room with life support equipment and 20 hanging spacesuits.
Bingo, Ted said. It's finally clear. This ship is intended to travel to the stars.
The others murmured, excited by the possibility. Suddenly, it all made sense. The great size, the vastness of the ship, the complexity of the control consoles.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Harry said. It can't have been made to travel to the stars. This is obviously a conventional spacecraft, although very large. And at conventional speeds, the nearest star is 250 years away.
Maybe they had new technology.
Where is it? There's no evidence of new technology.
Well, maybe it's...
Face the facts, Ted, Harry said. Even with this huge size, the ship is only provisioned for a few years, 15 or 20 years at most. How far could it go in that time? Barely out of the solar system, right?
Ted nodded dumbly.
It's true. It took the Voyager spacecraft 5 years to reach Jupiter, 9 years to reach Uranus, and 15 years... Maybe they were going to Pluto.
Why would anyone want to go to Pluto?
We don't know yet, but...
The radios squawked. The voice of Tina Chan said, Captain Barnes, surface wants you for a secure encrypted communication, sir.
Okay, Barnes said. It's time to go back anyway.
They headed back through the vast ship to the main entrance. Space and time. They were sitting in the lounge of DH-8, watching the divers work on the grid. Barnes was in the next cylinder, talking to the surface. Levy was cooking lunch, or dinner, a meal anyway. They were all getting confused about what the Navy people called surface time. Surface time doesn't matter down here, Edmund said in her precise librarian's voice. Day or night, it just doesn't make any difference. You get used to it. They nodded vaguely. Everyone was tired, Norman saw. The strain, the tension of the exploration, had taken its toll. Beth had already drifted off to sleep, feet up on the coffee table, her muscular arms folded across her chest. Outside the window, three small submarines had come down and were hovering over the grid. Several divers were clustered around. Others were heading back to the divers' habitat, DH-7. "Looks like something's up," Harry said. "Something to do with Barnes's call?" "Could be." Harry was still preoccupied, distracted. "Where's Tina Chan?" "She must be with Barnes. Why?" "I need to talk to her."
"What about?"
Ted said. "It's personal," Harry said. Ted raised his eyebrows, but said nothing more. Harry left, going into D-Sill. Norman and Ted were alone.
"He's a strange fellow," Ted said.
"Is he?"
"You know he is, Norman. Arrogant, too.
Probably because he's black. Compensating, don't you think?"
"I don't know."
"I'd say he has a chip on his shoulder," Ted said. "He seems to resent everything about this expedition." He sighed. "Of course, mathematicians are all strange. He's probably got no sort of life at all. I mean, a private life, women and so forth. Did I tell you I married again?"
"I read it somewhere," Norman said.
"She's a television reporter," Ted said.
"Wonderful woman."
He smiled. "When we got married, she gave me this Corvette. Beautiful 58 Corvette as a wedding present. You know that nice fire engine red color they had in the 50s? That color." Ted paced around the room, glanced over at Beth. "I just think this is all unbelievably exciting. I couldn't possibly sleep." Norman nodded. It was interesting how different they all were, he thought. Ted, eternally optimistic, with the bubbling enthusiasm of a child. Harry, with the cold, critical demeanor, the icy mind, the unblinking eye. Beth, not so intellectual or so cerebral, at once more physical and more emotional. That was why, though they were all exhausted, only Beth could sleep.
"Say, Norman," Ted said, "I thought you said this was going to be scary."
"I thought it would be," Norman said.
"Well," Ted said,
"of all the people who could be wrong about this expedition, I'm glad it was you."
"I am too.
Although I can't imagine why you would select a man like Harry Adams for this team. Not that he isn't distinguished, but..." Norman didn't want to talk about Harry. "Ted, remember back on the ship when you said space and time are aspects of the same thing?"
"Space-time, yes."
"I've never really understood that."
"Why, it's quite straightforward."
"You can explain it to me?"
"Sure."
"In English," Norman said.
"You mean explain it without mathematics?"
"Yes."
"Well, I'll try."
Ted frowned, but Norman knew he was pleased. Ted loved to lecture. He paused for a moment, then said, "Okay, let's see where we need to begin. You're familiar with the idea that gravity is just geometry?"
"No."
"Curvature of space and time?"
"Not really, no."
Einstein's general relativity?"
"Sorry," Norman said.
"Never mind," Ted said. There was a bowl of fruit on the table. Ted emptied the bowl, setting the fruit on the table. "Okay, this table is space. Nice, flat space."
"Okay," Norman said.
Ted began to position the pieces of fruit. "This orange is the sun. And these are the planets which move in circles around the sun. So we have the solar system on this table."
"Okay."
"Fine," Ted said. "Now, the sun," he pointed to the orange in the center of the table, "is very large, so it has a lot of gravity."
"Right."
Ted gave Norman a ball bearing. "This is a spaceship. I want you to send it through the solar system so it passes very close to the sun, okay?" Norman took the ball bearing and rolled it so it passed close to the orange.
"Okay."
you notice that your ball rolls straight across the flat table.
Right.
But in real life, what would happen to your spacecraft when it passed near the sun?
It would get sucked into the sun.
Yes. We say it would fall into the sun. The spacecraft would curve inward from a straight line and hit the sun. But your spacecraft didn't.
No.
So we know that the flat table is wrong, Ted said. Real space can't be flat like the table.
It can't?
No, Ted said. He took the empty bowl and set the orange in the bottom. Now, roll your ball straight across past the sun.
Norman flicked the ball bearing into the bowl. The ball curved and spiraled down the inside of the bowl until it hit the orange.
Okay, Ted said. The spacecraft hit the sun just like it would in real life.
But if I gave it enough speed, Norman said, it'd go right past it. It'd roll down and up the far side of the bowl and out again.
Correct, Ted said. Also like real life, if the spacecraft has enough velocity, it will escape the gravitational field of the sun.
Right.
So, Ted said, what we are showing is that a spacecraft passing the sun in real life behaves as if it were entering a curved region of space around the sun. Space around the sun is curved like this bowl.
Okay.
And if your ball had the right speed, it wouldn't escape from the bowl, but instead would just spiral around endlessly inside the rim of the bowl. And that's what the planets are doing. They are endlessly spiraling inside the bowl created by the sun.
He put the orange back on the table. In reality, you should imagine the table is made out of rubber, and the planets are all making dents in the rubber as they sit there. That's what space is really like. Real space is curved, and the curvature changes with the amount of gravity.
Yes.
So, Ted said, space is curved by gravity.
Okay.
And that means that you can think of gravity as nothing more than the curvature of space. The Earth has gravity because the Earth curves the space around it.
Okay.
Except,
it's not that simple, Ted said.
Norman sighed. I didn't think it would be.
Harry came back into the room, looked at the fruit on the table, but said nothing.
Now, Ted said, when you roll your ball bearing across the bowl, you notice that it not only spirals down, but it also goes faster, right?
Yes.
Now, when an object goes faster, time on that object passes slower.
Einstein proved that early in the century.
What it means is that you can think of the curvature of space as also representing a curvature of time. The deeper the curve in the bowl, the slower time passes.
Harry said, well, layman's terms, Ted said, give the guy a break.
Yeah, Norman said, give the guy a break.
Ted held up the bowl.
Now, if you're doing all this mathematically, what you find is that the curved bowl is neither space nor time, but the combination of both, which is called space-time. This bowl is space-time, and objects moving on it are moving in space-time.
We don't think about movement that way, but that's really what's happening.
It is? Sure, take baseball.
Idiot game, Harry said. I hate games.
You know baseball? Ted said to Norman.
Yes, Norman said.
Okay, imagine the batter hits a line drive to the center fielder. The ball goes almost straight out and takes, say, half a second.
Right.
Now, imagine the batter hits a high pop fly to the same center fielder. This time the ball goes way up in the air, and it takes 6 seconds before the center fielder catches it.
Okay.
Now, the paths of the two balls, the line drive and the pop fly, look very different to us. But both these balls moved exactly the same in space-time.
No, Norman said.
Yes, Ted said. And in a way, you already know it. Suppose I ask you to hit a high pop fly to the center fielder, but to make it reach the fielder in half a second instead of 6 seconds.
That's impossible, Norman said.
Why? Just hit the pop fly harder.
If I hit it harder, it will go higher and end up taking longer.
Okay, then hit a low-line drive that takes 6 seconds to reach center field.
I can't do that either.
Right, Ted said. So what you are telling me is that you can't make the ball do anything you want. There is a fixed relationship governing the path of the ball through space and time.
Sure, because the Earth has gravity.
Yes, Ted said. And we've already agreed that gravity is a curvature of space-time, like the curve of this bowl. Any baseball on Earth must move along the same curve of space-time as this ball bearing moves along this bowl. Look. He put the orange back in the bowl. Here's the Earth. He put two fingers on opposite sides of the orange. Here's batter and fielder. Now, roll the ball bearing from one finger to the other, and you'll find you have to accommodate the curve of the bowl. Either you flick the ball lightly and it will roll close to the orange, or you can give it a big flick and it will go way up the side of the bowl before falling down again to the other side. But you can't make this ball bearing do anything you want because the ball bearing is moving along the curved bowl. And that's what your baseball is really doing. It's moving on curved space-time. Norman said, I sort of get it. But what does this have to do with time travel? Well, we think the gravitational field of the Earth is strong. It hurts us when we fall down. But in reality, it's very weak. It's almost non-existent. So space-time around the Earth isn't very curved. Space-time is much more curved around the Sun. And in other parts of the universe, it's very curved, producing a sort of roller coaster ride, and all sorts of distortions of time may occur. In fact, if you consider a black hole... He broke off. Yes, Ted? A black hole? Oh, my God, Ted said softly. Harry pushed his glasses up on his nose and said, Ted, for once in your life, you just might be right. They both grabbed for paper, began scribbling. It couldn't be a Schwarzschild hole. No, have to be rotating. Angular momentum would assure that... And you couldn't approach the singularity. No, the tidal forces rip you apart. But if you just dipped below the event horizon... Is it possible? Did they have the nerve? The two fell silent, making calculations, muttering to themselves. What is it about a black hole? Norman said. But they weren't listening to him anymore. The intercom clicked. Barnes said, Attention, this is the captain speaking. I want all hands in the conference room on the double. We're in the conference room, Norman said. On the double, now. We're already there, Hal. That is all, Barnes said, and the intercom clicked off. The conference. I've just been on the scrambler with Admiral Spaulding of SyncCom Pack Honolulu, Barnes said. Apparently Spaulding just learned that I had taken civilians to saturated depths for a project about which he knew nothing. He wasn't happy about it. There was a silence. They all looked at him. He demanded that all the civilians be sent up topside. Good, Norman thought. He had been disappointed by what they had found so far. The prospect of spending another 72 hours in this humid, claustrophobic environment while they investigated an empty space vehicle did not appeal to him. I thought, Ted said, we had direct authorization from the president. We do, Barnes said. But there is the question of the storm. What storm? Harry said. They're reporting 50-knot winds and southeast swells on the surface. It looks like a Pacific cyclone is headed our way and will reach us within 24 hours.
There's going to be a storm here? Beth said.
Not here, Barnes said. Down here we won't feel anything, but it'll be rough on the surface. All our surface support ships may have to pull out and steam for protected harbors in Tonga.
So we'd be left alone down here?
For 24 to 48 hours, yes. That wouldn't be a problem. We're entirely self-sufficient. But Spaulding is nervous about pulling surface support when there are civilians below. I want to know your feelings. Do you want to stay down and continue exploring the ship, or leave?
Stay, definitely, Ted said.
Barnes said, Beth. I came here to investigate unknown life, Beth said. But there isn't any life on that ship. It just isn't what I thought it would be, and hoped it would be. I say we go. Barnes said, Norman. Let's admit the truth, Norman said. We're not really trained for a saturated environment, and we're not really comfortable down here. At least I'm not. And we're not the best people to evaluate this spacecraft. At this point, the Navy'd be much better off with a team of NASA engineers. I say go.
Harry?
Let's get the hell out,
Harry said. Any particular reason? Barnes said.
Call it intuition.
Ted said,
I can't believe you would say that, Harry, just when we have this fabulous new idea about the ship.
That's beside the point now, Barnes said crisply. I'll make the arrangements with the surface to pull us out in another 12 hours.
Ted said, God damn it.
But Norman was looking at Barnes. Barnes wasn't upset. He wants to leave, he thought. He's looking for an excuse to leave, and we're providing his excuse. Meantime, Barnes said, we can make one and perhaps even two more trips to the ship. We'll rest for the next 2 hours and then go back. And that's all for now.
I have more I'd like to say.
That's all, Ted. The vote's been taken. Get some rest.
As they headed toward their bunks, Barnes said,
Beth, I'd like a word with you, please.
What about?
Beth, when we go back to the ship, I don't want you pushing every button you come across.
All I did was turn on the lights, Hal.
Yes, but you didn't know that when you...
Sure I did. The button said room lights. It was pretty clear.
As they moved off, they heard Beth say, I'm not one of your little Navy people you can order around, Hal. And then Barnes said something else, and the voices faded.
Damn it, Ted said.
He kicked one of the iron walls. It rang hollowly. They passed into C cylinder on their way to the bunks.
I can't believe you people want to leave, Ted said. This is such an exciting discovery. How can you walk away from it? Especially you, Harry. The mathematical possibilities alone. The theory of the black hole.
I'll tell you why, Harry said. I want to go because Barnes wants to go.
Barnes doesn't want to go, Ted said. Why, he put it to a vote.
I know what he did, but Barnes doesn't want to look as if he's made the wrong decision in the eyes of his superiors, or as if he's backing down, so he let us decide. But I'm telling you, Barnes wants to go. Norman was surprised. The cliché image of mathematicians was that they had their heads in the clouds, were absent-minded, inattentive. But Harry was astute. He didn't miss a thing.
Why would Barnes want to go? Ted said.
I think it's clear, Harry said. Because of the storm on the surface.
The storm isn't here yet, Ted said.
No, Harry said. And when it comes, we don't know how long it will last.
Barnes said 24 to 48 hours.
Neither Barnes nor anyone else can predict how long the storm will last, Harry said. What if it lasts 5 days?
We can hold out that long. We have air and supplies for 5 days. What are you so worried about?
I'm not worried, Harry said. But I think Barnes is worried.
Nothing will go wrong, for Christ's sake, Ted said. I think we should stay.
And then there was a squishing sound. They looked down at the all-weather carpeting at their feet. The carpet was dark, soaked.
What's that?
I'd say it was water, Harry said.
Salt water?
Ted said, bending over, touching the damp spot. He licked his finger.
Doesn't taste salty.
From above them, a voice said, That's because it's urine. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.